All right, next matter is Philip Robert Brooks against the Commonwealth, Mr. Mazzio and Mr. Fitzgerald.
Morning again, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, I'm Dan Mazzio on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Brooks, and I will take up first the issue, the first assignment of error having to do with the issue of fatal variance.
Excuse me, isn't the bottom line of your argument, who's out the money?
Essentially, I might put it a little bit differently, who possessed the money that was taken from them. That's a little bit wordy. I'm trying to frame it exactly, precisely, but yes, that's the issue. Who was the victim of this theft, correct? Who was out the money? That is the issue. I think, in fact, from reading the Commonwealth's response, I think we may agree on the state of the law as it set in the Gardner case, right up until the point when, in this case, Ms. Shaw takes physical possession of the money. So up until that point, had Mr. Brooks been the one that went into the bank and withdrew this money, I think, at least my reading of the Commonwealth's response, we would both potentially agree that it would be the bank who was, at that point, the victim.
Can you speak to that as it relates to Gardner? Because essentially what Gardner's indicating is because the grandfather didn't consent to releasing the funds and they had no authority then to give the funds to the granddaughter. That's essentially why bank is the victim, boiled down to its simplest misunderstanding. In this particular case, factually, it's different. The holder of the bank account actually goes in, withdraws the funds, and actually takes the funds and gives them to the appellant.
Right.
And then also, the holder of the account then is the person who is on the hook for paying back the money. In fact, has to pay back the money. So are those factual distinctions enough to take it out of Gardner and the fatal variance?
Well, I'd say two things. First, as it relates to paying back the money, it's clear that the bank asks Ms. Shaw to pay back the money and that she does begin participating in paying back the money. I don't think it's clear necessarily just because that occurred that was an obligation that she, in fact, needed to take on. Whether or not had...
What about the fact that she actually goes and takes the money out of the bank, which is different from Gardner?
Right.
What they essentially talk about in these successive cases is about the debtor relationship that they have with the bank, and that it is in fact that there is this taking out of the funds without authority. Here there's the taking with authority.
But she put it in her own account and withdrew it from her account, didn't she?
That's correct. And I think Your Honor, I would agree with you as far as where that issue diverges, and it's right there. It's at the point where in Gardner case it's not the account holder that goes in to take the money out. In this case, it is, and I think that becomes the question here.
Well, on brief, you argue that the difference is that here, Shaw, quote, never intended to obtain a legal right to the currency, close quotes. I think it's certainly clear she never intended to retain a legal right to the currency because that wasn't the arrangement, but that's different from whether she actually obtained it. In that vein, I'm looking at Bennett against First and Merchants National Bank from our Supreme Court back in 1987. And the court held in that case the relationship between a financial institution and its depositor is that of debtor and creditor. The funds become the property of the bank immediately upon deposit, and the bank becomes the debtor of the depositor. It seems to me that the inverse then also has to be true, which means when the money goes the other way, the opposite happens. And if that's the case, we don't have a problem here.
I would draw two distinctions, and I don't disagree with your assessment of the law, but I would draw two distinctions as it relates to the facts of this case. The first, I would argue that in this situation, there was never a point at which the bank became, in actuality, a debtor to Ms. Shaw. The check that was presented was, from the beginning, fraudulent. So the money that, in theory, had been given to the bank by Ms. Shaw that would have created the debtor-creditor relationship was non-existent funds. There was actually no, and it gets a little bit complicated in terms of the difference between electronic funds and physical funds, but there was in actuality no funds ever given by Ms. Shaw to the bank for them to be, in fact, a creditor.
How is that any different than if she, say, writes a check on her account that actually withdraws it? She's not necessarily legally entitled to those funds either. the responsibility is not that different in terms of whether she's on the hook for it.
Well, I think that the question is, was that if the overdraw was an unintentional mistake on behalf of the drawer versus it being the events of a fraudulent behavior, there may in fact have been
a... If it's an overdraft, she's still responsible for it.
But my suggestion is if there was a fraudulent intent, it may in fact be criminal in nature from the drawer. It would depend on whether or not that those facts could be determined.
How does intent affect the argument that you just made about the funds and how they're in there
Because I think it affects that debtor-creditor relationship. If an individual goes into the bank with the intent to create that debtor-creditor relationship, but in fact there are no funds to be exchanged, then that relationship is from the jump fraudulent. I think it's helpful, at least as I've been trying to frame this case. I think it's helpful from my perspective to consider a set of facts where Ms. Shaw had a substantial amount of money in her account. Beyond what would have prevented her from getting into an overdraft situation. Had she had a substantial amount of funds in her account, gone in, presented the check, withdrawn funds, and then eventually that balance was corrected to exclude the non-existent money from that check that was cashed, I think Michelle would in fact be the victim. Then the funds would have belonged to her. They would have been in actuality her funds that were withdrawn from the bank.
She thinks it's his aunt's check. That's what she's been told.
Yes, I know that is. I agree. I would agree that is her perspective. I don't think that changes my argument, however.
Well, how does it affect it in terms of how we have to view the evidence?
I don't think that changes the way the court needs to view the evidence as it relates to who the victim in actuality is in this case. Had Michelle known that the check was fraudulent, I think that opens up an entirely different can of worms. That relates more to my second assignment of error and changes the dynamic. And then, of course, certainly at that point, then the bank is in fact the victim, had Ms. Shaw been aware. The fact that she's not aware, I would concede that was her testimony at trial, but I don't think that changes the nature of our argument as it relates to the variance on the victim in this case.
But when she deposited that check, it was her money,
wasn't it? Well,
she put it in her account, wasn't it her money?
Her perception at the time was that she was depositing a check. In actuality, there was no money. There was never going to be an exchange of funds. That
to me, that's a separate issue. She deposited money into her own account, and she withdrew those same funds from her account. So I guess my bottom line question is, how is the bank a victim?
Well, if we follow that line of thought, if Michelle is in fact the victim and the bank is not the victim in this case, then the bank's threat to Michelle that they're going to contact the police, it would be ineffectual. They would not be the victim of any crime. They would be the actual institution that
threatened all the time.
Yes, no, understood, and that's certainly what. They never had to come to a conclusion as to whether or not they could follow through on that, but the logical conclusion of Michelle being the victim in this case is that the bank is not, and therefore the money that's owed to them would be not owed to them as the result of any fraud. It would simply be a simple exchange between them and Michelle, and I would argue that that doesn't make logical sense here.
Well, I don't think we can predicate a decision in this case on what the bank thinks they're entitled to or not entitled to. The question is what the law, recognizes.
And I only reference that just to suggest that there's an understanding at that point from the bank and Ms. Shaw that they are the ones that are in fact out this money, and that there's an obligation now. Someone needs to make the bank whole. The only reason the bank would be needing to be made whole is because they were in fact out the $1,500. That was the amount of funds that the bank was at a loss of. That's why her account is negative. That's why they go through the process of having to pay that back. If the bank is not the victim in this case, it's difficult to understand how they have been out the $1,500 as the result of a fraud.
Why does she need to pay it back?
I would argue she did not. I would argue had she actually gone to the police, as would have been reasonable in this case, right off the bat, once she realized what happened, had made a police report, and they had investigated, I would argue that she could take the position.
She did. She just didn't have identifying information on her appellant in order to get.
Her testimony was that she did not. However, when she went back to the police at a later date with the exact same situation, then there was... suddenly, the ability to create a police report at that time.
To see him in the
don't think she was that specific. She had seen him in the neighborhood. I don't think she was specific.
That neighborhood, and from that, whatever transpired, she went to the police.
And I would I would suggest that as it relates to the second sign of error, that there's that's highly questionable whether or not the police would have refused her the ability to take a report without having identifying information. I don't think that's how the police department works. I think that that seems unlikely. However, in the light most favorably, yes, that was her position, that she tried to do that. The fact that she failed, I don't think changes the dynamic of whether or not she should have had to pay that money back to the bank if she was, in fact, just a victim of this fraud in and of herself. I think that would inherently, I would also give the example of if Mr. Brooks had been charged, if it was determined that Ms. Shaw was involved in the fraud, in a similar hypothetical, and Mr. Brooks had been charged also in the same theft working with Ms. Shaw, they had both obtained the money under false pretenses, that would require the bank to be the victim in this case. And as we sift through that, I think the factual distinction is twofold. First, that the funds never existed for the bank to release them lawfully to Ms. Shaw. She was never the lawful owner of the funds because they never existed in the first place for the bank to be paid out. When they were given to her, they belonged to the bank because there was no lawful right outside of fraud for her to be given ownership of those funds. But secondarily, even if the court were to determine that had occurred and that those had transferred into her ownership, at least physically at that point, I would suggest that she never has the intention of actually being holding legal title to this money. It's not in a situation where she requires payment or there's some type of exchange for her cashing this check. She sees herself, per her testimony, as merely a pass-through throughout the entirety of these circumstances. If she's to be believed in her testimony that she takes this check purely to cash it for someone else, she walks into the bank, that it remains her intent the entire time, and at best, at that point, she's an agent of Mr. Brooks going into the bank. There's no point at which she intends to take legal title of those funds. She knows, if her testimony is to be believed, that they don't.
Mr. Brooks, with respect to the bank, because Brooks has no banking relationship with the bank. So, I mean, it seems to me that, and I guess the record isn't really clear on this, but, you know, just based on my own, you know, being involved in this stuff for a long time, I don't know what her bank balance was at the time. Just hypothetically, if she had $100,000 in her bank account, and this you know, they stopped paying on this check, all the bank would have done would be to, you know, deduct that amount from her balance, and we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
I would agree.
She would still be the one out the money.
And she, in that situation, she would be the victim in that case because
so
the funds.
Why does it make any analytical difference if she doesn't have $100,000 in the bank and she has to pay the money back because the bank's now out?
Because in the first situation, the funds in her account were lawfully hers. They existed. They had, in fact, been given to the bank, created that debtor-creditor relationship, and it was those lawful funds that she had legal title to with Corbett's draw, which were withdrawn and then given over to Mr.
There's
Brooks.
There's no case law that supports that distinction that you're carving out.
There's not, and I would ask this court to explore that issue. I think the furthest that we've gotten in specifics is what we have from Gardner. I think the facts of this are a little bit different. But again, I would argue if she had the funds, I would agree Ms. Shaw would be the victim in this case. Because she did not in the account, and because there was never, in reality, the relationship created outside of the fraud, I would argue the bank is the victim, and even if the court disagreed with me on that point, that for purposes of maintaining ownership of this money, that Ms. Shaw was an agent of Mr. Brooks. I understand the court's distinction there between the bank's perspective and Ms. Shaw's, but that would be the position I'd take this morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. Again, I'm Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth in this case. The distinction that Judge Malvo drew between this case and Gardner is the crucial factual distinction in this case, and it is what makes the victim, Shaw, the correct victim here. There was no fatal variance because the money, which was withdrawn by Shaw, who was an account holder at the bank, lawfully withdrawn by her, in her possession, cashed by her at her own bank, and then handed to the defendant, that's the money that we're talking about. That money was lawfully hers when the defendant obtained it from her. For the same reason stated in Gardner, that victim was not the lawful holder there. And really, how much money she had in her account doesn't change her relationship with the bank. She has lawful title and possession to that money when she obtains it duly from her own account. And that's the Commonwealth's position in this case. With respect to the second assignment, very briefly, the defense did not address it, but I would submit that the credibility of the victim is an issue for the jury to decide in this case, and the trial court correctly found that. The cases cited in that regard are inapposite. There's some older rape cases talking about whether a chaste and God-fearing woman would get in the back of the car with these folks, and I think our evolving standards in that area have changed, and certainly we don't have anything that rises to that level in this case. I'm happy to stand on my brief in that regard unless the court has further questions. No. Thank you. I ask you to affirm.
I'll work in reverse here very briefly. I'll just address the second assignment. I understand the court's deference toward the fact finder and the situation that that any assignment of error such as that begins in. However, I would suggest the facts of this case, the suggestion that Ms. Shaw was completely innocent, unknowing party, based on all the ins and outs of the different banks, the different trips, the links that were gone through to have no verification of any kind along the way, make it incredibly unlikely to believe that she could have been naive enough or at least unquestioning enough to go through all of those different trips to multiple different banks to prevent anyone from at any point checking into these funds. And I'll leave my argument as second assignment of error there. And I'll go back briefly. I know I'm running out of time here, but the Gummel's position is that the money was lawfully hers when Brooks obtained it from her. And I think it is difficult to square the fact that a bank could be the actual institution who gives away the funds that were never lawfully belong to anyone but the bank at that point, solely as the result of fraud, and that could be a lawful transfer of $1,500 to another individual of those funds without some intervening act.
All right, thank you, counsel. We'll come down to recounsel and we'll take up.